Today we're going to continue exploring the teachings of Lojong, which is a Tibetan Buddhist practice that offers a way to meditate with pithy teachings, right? Short phrases that are very helpful in just being reminded of what ushers in a genuine sense of well-being, a genuine sense of spaciousness and clarity, and also what the obstacles are to that well-being. And today we're going to return to one of the obstacles, and also the potential to transform the obstacle, which is anger. And I was having a look at what I had called our gathering, the title for our gathering today, which I believe was Transforming Anger, Finding an Inner Guide, something along those lines. And I was appreciating that frame, because often it's tempting, as we've talked about in prior gatherings, to imagine that anger is an inherent obstacle, that it's an inherent impediment to our spiritual development and to our psychological development. And I think this has something to do with how challenging it can be to feel strong anger. Right? It's not an easy affect, to use a clinical term. It's not an easy feeling. Right, it tends to come with heat, right? And for those of you who are in my stage of life, you know that those uprisings of heat sometimes are a little uncomfortable, right? They arise, and then there's this question of what to do, right? There's this energy, there's this presence. What am I going to do with it? It can feel powerful. Now, in the sutras, in the Sutrayana tradition, there are bountiful teachings that encourage us to basically uproot anger from the mind. And there's the suggestion that that's possible, that we could become so attuned with the reality of who we are, which is, from a Buddhist perspective, extraordinarily awake and insightful and kind and compassionate, that's really our deepest nature, and that we could access that level of the human condition and awaken those capacities so that really is our ongoing reality, rather than the more customary experience of neurosis coming up, and anxiety coming up, and anger coming up, frustration, despair. Right? If you're like me, you know those waves of emotional impediments or struggles. I might want to add to that Sutrayana perspective, and you find this in other Buddhist teachings, that actually anger, like all feelings, is not inherently problematic, right? It is dynamic. In the same way love, right? Feelings of love are dynamic, right? Or feelings of compassion are dynamic. All feelings change, right? To emote means to come up and out. So really the question is, how are we relating to anger? What are we doing with it? Right? What are the narratives that get attached to it? And I think part of the reason why anger can feel so problematic and frankly frightening is that it's tempting to get stuck in anger. Right, especially if it reaches a certain threshold. Right, it's one thing to be frustrated with a friend who said they would call on Friday, but they don't actually call until Sunday. That's frustrating. We don't love it. Or it's frustrating sometimes if we're trying to get out of the subway train and nobody's letting us out. That's annoying. Nobody likes it. It's another thing, though, to feel deliberately harmed, or for someone you love or people you love to be deliberately harmed. Outrage. Right? That's a different threshold of anger. It can move into the territory of hatred, of rage. Right? These are powerful feelings. And I really do appreciate why they can feel so disturbing, because anyone who's ever felt the stronger, more intense experience of anger, which I would call rage or hatred, knows how difficult it is for that to settle. It can start to feel like it's burning us up, right? It's so hot, it's so powerful. But sometimes there's fear that we're not going to be able to recover, or that other people could get harmed by it and they won't be able to recover. Yeah. So the clinician in me, most of you know I'm also a therapist, wants to suggest, and the Buddhist in me too, wants to suggest that Even that intensity of affect, that intensity of anger, can be worked with skillfully. It can be worked with and related to, right, in a generative, non-harming way. It's just that most of us need a lot of help, right, and lots of tools figuring out how that works. Yeah. So in the sutras, as we've talked about, patience is offered as one method for working with anger. Because the more patient we are, the more likely we are to wait, right? To try to understand what's in the anger. What are the components? Because it's never usually one trigger. It's usually a mosaic. Right, and usually a very complex mosaic that triggers, especially the powerful anger. Again, it's very simple. If we're trying to get off the train, we have to get to work, we have to get to a doctor's appointment, everybody's listening to their headphones, they're staring at their device. It's an obvious trigger, right? And there's not a lot of complexity to it. It's another thing entirely if someone we have loved profoundly disappoints us, right? Or a group that we have felt held by, cared for, suddenly is not available or seems to be behaving in a way that is really malattuned to what we're experiencing or needing, right? Or a relationship that we thought we understood reveals itself to have some other dynamic that is shocking. These experiences usually have a lot of complexity, right? They're really multifaceted. Now, of course, the mind doesn't like that. The mind wants to know what's going on, wants to be able to figure out a response, and wants to be able to get over the suffering. Right, which is why most of us tend to have these two limited narratives about what's actually happening. It's the mind's effort to get control. Right? So there's a part of us that says, I understand what this is. It's such and such a person and their narcissism. End of story. Right? Or such and such a group and their... their selfishness, right, their greed, whatever it is, there's usually a one-dimensional narration that starts to feel like it's absolutely true, right? Has unquestioned validity. And if only the other person or group would get it, would get the memo and internalize it, then we wouldn't have a problem. I know that experience very well. And of returning to the narrative again and again, and if only they could understand what is clearly true. But the mind just gets more and more agitated, right? More and more distraught. And I'm not suggesting that we should circumvent or try to disrespect that process, because it's a very human process. And it comes from a good intention, which is to feel a sense of agency, to feel like there's something we can do about our suffering. Right, so the intention is usually a good one. It's just that it lacks the spaciousness for the fuller, more complex truth. Thus, patience is offered as one of the bodhisattva's ways, right? One of the healing ways of helping us slow down enough so that we can begin to understand more about our own experience, the reality of others, the reality of what gets created between us, right? That third reality, which is usually where things happen. That just takes a while for most people. It's not usually an instantaneous clarity. Thus, patience can be so helpful with anger. And again, I'm pretty good at this when it comes to the more benign experiences of anger. Not so good when it comes to the more charged experiences, because it's much harder, I have found, to really slow down the reactivity. Yeah. So patience, that would be a great tool to consider, to practice, to be curious about. And in the Lojong teachings, there are a few additional methods that are quite helpful, and so I'll share a couple with you. This is one, and there are a number. And it says, don't react on impulse to critical remarks. Don't react on impulse to critical remarks. If only that were easy. If only that felt good.
Well, it depends on the form of criticism.
Absolutely. Right, and that's such a good point, because, for instance, you could have a mentor whom you trust, right, and whom you have enough experience with, right, to really trust that they have your best, right, your well-being at heart. And so that if they're offering you critical feedback, it comes with a good intention. It's still not easy, right? It's still not easy, but it might not have such a painful impact. It's another thing if you sense someone is actually trying to get something by demeaning you or disempowering you, right? Then there's usually a part that responds with indignation. There are a lot of teachings in the Buddha Dharma, right? That's the part that feels separate, like a separate I. How could you say that to me? I am disgusted. I am upset, right? We often in those moments feel a sense of powerful separation. Right, we're not on the same team anymore. We don't belong to the same family anymore. We are not interdependent in those moments. Right, we are fundamentally separate in those moments. But in the Buddha Dharma, the idea is that if we can slowly cultivate a genuine feeling of interdependence, interbeing, that it becomes easier to not react to those remarks. Right? Don't react on impulse to critical remarks. My hunch is that has something to do with really allowing the mind to start to feel, again, on the deepest recesses of our being, that we're all Buddhas, right? Or whatever your faith tradition, we're all children of God, right? If you really feel that, then that's what you're going to be appealing to in others. And so if the behavior is critical, then there is that deeper experience that undergirds our response. Does that make sense? Yeah. Sit with it for a moment and then we'll come back to some of the doubts. So don't react on impulse to critical remarks. Now, I think that teaching does not suggest that we can't think critically, right? We can't use our analytical thinking skills about how we're being treated, and that we cannot protect ourselves when we need to. But really, the foundational teaching in the Buddha Dharma is do no harm to oneself and others. Do no harm, be as helpful as you can. And so if someone is mistreating you, that's important. That's important to recognize and to see, to understand, right? And to assess what's needed here to not be harmed. But that would be different from reacting on impulse, right, to a statement that we don't like, that doesn't feel good, that might be insulting. Yeah. So it's interesting just to practice. Right? Sometimes these teachings, they sound like they make sense, they're a good idea on a conceptual level. There's the reality of relationship, which is so mind-bendingly challenging, right? And filled with difficulty and conflict, and everybody has problems, and then when we both have problems, oh, it can be a mess. So that's why the Buddha said, keep practicing. It's great to study, it's so important, it's wonderful to talk to each other. I'm so grateful to all of you because I get to keep learning with you. But then how to practice, right? And perhaps to let the next encounter with someone who is a little insulting be fodder for practice, right? What would it be like to sustain wakefulness in that moment? Not just when somebody is praising you, right? I mean, I love it when people praise me. I love it. It makes me feel so good. I often say I'm happiest, right? When people are treating me like the Queen of England. Great. But that's not something that I can count on, right? And it's too conditional. It's just too conditional. It means that I'm only going to be loving in response. I'm only going to be compassionate in response if I get that affirmation, that validation, right? If I get that ego massage. The real work, and I'm right there with you working on this, is to somehow sustain, right, that wakefulness, that recognition of our shared Buddha nature, even in the midst of difficulty, yeah, and conflict. All right, so the next pithy statement, I like this one a lot. Don't wait in ambush. funny, right? Because it really is. I think it's part of the human condition to become strategic, right? When we're really feeling done to, mistreated, right? The mind really starts to kick into gear around what we're going to do, right? To rectify the situation, right? To get our just rewards, right? We're gonna wait. Don't wait in ambush. It's another powerful teaching, right? Because again, probably none of us get into that state of mind when the trigger is moderate. Right? So again, you can think of countless examples of going to the grocery store and the person who's checking you out is throwing your groceries into a bag. Who likes it? Nobody likes it. Right? Or somebody who is walking with you is basically pushing you out of the way to get to where they're going. None of us like that. It doesn't feel good. But, right, the feelings again can get quite intensified when we feel more personally harmed, more personally done to. Then there's often that retaliatory part that is waiting in ambush. Even if we have been enculturated or socialized to carefully contain our anger, some of us have been, right? Some of us were raised to do everything possible to never express anger directly. And we might have gotten a message, both tacit and direct, from our caregivers that anger is unacceptable. It's too much, right? The loving tie, or whatever tie there is, will not be sustainable if you express it, right? So I want to acknowledge that for many people, there are parts that say, don't reveal this anger. Feel it, but don't expose it. Now, this, of course, becomes complicated when there's that part waiting in ambush, because it's especially hidden, right? And as a result, it can fester, right? It's not actually getting the exposure or the relief or the help that part is needing. It's just waiting. And maybe even with this notion that they're going to have to wait for years, decades, until that right moment arrives. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, probably because we all identify with that experience. But it's also very poignant because it's a painful experience, right? It's painful to feel so harmed, so enraged. And this is the important thing about anger and rage, is it usually is an indicator of having been hurt, right? Having been badly hurt. But when we sense our suffering is not being recognized by the person or the group that has harmed us, usually then it stirs anger, hatred, rage. How could you not know how hurt I am? How could you not care? How could you not try to work it out? Right? Apologize. Just recognize the suffering. That's usually where the rage comes in, the absence of that working through, the absence of that suffering. Which is why if we've been socialized, right, to somehow split off the anger, then it's a problem. Because if we know there's a part waiting, right, waiting to ambush, then we can work with that part, right? And perhaps bring that part into conversation with other parts that are understanding internally, right? Our Buddha nature that says, I get it. This situation has been so painful. And often there's a lot of loss involved, right? You might have felt you lost something precious, lost something needed. And so that internal recognition from the part that says, I understand, this has been a devastating loss. And maybe together we can hold the anger. We don't have to get rid of it, right? We don't have to even transform it just yet, even though that was the title of this talk. That can be an aspiration. It's a lovely aspiration, but it doesn't even have to happen immediately. We can just hold it. Right? In the same way any of you would hold an enraged child, right, who is overcome with feeling that they're just not ready to work with, they might actually need that emotional and physical holding. We have those young parts that need the internal holding.